com. Good evening, Africa, and welcome to Upfront from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. This week on Upfront,
upstanders are people who are present, including virtually present, at a crisis, and do intervene on behalf of the victim.
That is Professor Zachary Kaufman of the University of Houston Law School. He will be speaking to us about digital upstanders and bystanders. Also, a global outcry as Nigeria bans the popular social media platform. But what is really behind the Twitter ban in Africa's most populous nation?
Lots of people use Twitter directly for their businesses. The banks cannot tweet, for instance. Other organizations, corporates, public, private, cannot tweet. So that's an entire shutdown of more or less a market space.
That is JJ Omojua, Nigerian writer and social commentator. He joins us from Abuja. As the use of digital technology becomes more ubiquitous and of common use throughout the world, we have all been inadvertently transformed into digital citizens, often operating in spaces where some of the basic rules or code of conduct are still unwritten, more or less codified into law, a situation that has given rise to a number of unforeseen social and ethical issues. Now, as the use of digital technology becomes more ubiquitous and of common use throughout the world, we have all been inadvertently transformed into digital citizens, often operating in spaces where some of the basic rules or code of conduct are still unwritten, more or less codified into law. And this situation has given rise to a number of unforeseen social and ethical issues. But as scholarship around this area starts to ponder the question of one's role in the community, there is consensus that the baseline is we all need to act more conscientiously as digital citizens, guided by the same values and principles or ethics that make one an upstanding citizen. And we are starting to see that there is a price to pay for how one acts or fails to act as they engage with technology and society. For example, this June, the teenager who recorded the infamous video showing George Floyd's murder at the hands of a Minneapolis policeman was awarded the prestigious 2021 Pulitzer Prize Special Citation. The Pulitzer Board said that they were awarding Daniela Frazier for, quote, courageously recording the murder of George Floyd, a video that sparked protests against police brutality around the world, highlighting the crucial role of citizens in journalists' quest for truth and justice. Now, legal scholars, including my next guest, are examining the issue of personal responsibility in the digital age and conclude that even though not intervening or not reporting a crime which is taking place may or may not be a criminal act, your individual actions classify you as either being a digital bystander or digital upstander, depending on the circumstances. Dr. Zachary Kaufman is Associate Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of Houston Law Center. He has written extensively on this topic and joins me to discuss this issue of digital bystanders and upstanders. Professor Kaufman, it's great to have you on the show. Let's talk about this phenomenon that you have been researching and writing about for a number of years now. And that is to do with upstanders and bystanders. How do you describe these two concepts? What is a bystander and what is an upstander?
So first of all, Jackson, thank you so much for having me back on the show. I always love speaking with you and engaging with your audience. My research has really been focusing recently on an age-old question. What duties, if any, should we owe our fellow human beings in a time of crisis? And of course, as you know, there are all types of crises and they're all, crises all around us all the time. And so there are basically two types of third parties, you know, two types of witnesses, and they are bystanders and upstanders. So bystanders are people who are present at a crisis, and I argue that also that should include people who are digitally present, who are present at a crisis, but they don't participate. They're just passive onlookers. On the other hand, upstanders are people who are present, including virtually present, at a crisis, and do intervene on behalf of the victim. So contrary to bystanders, they are proactive helpers.
Now, social scientists say that empathy, to have cognitive, emotional, moral capacities, to understand and respond to the suffering of others. And I assume that we all have those qualities on some level. However, we have seen cases where people refuse to act or provide help when others are in danger. They stand by and watch. And this is especially when people are in groups. Why do people choose to remain bystanders? And is there something to groupthink that compels people to be bystanders rather than upstanders?
Absolutely, Jackson. There are lots of reasons, or we might say excuses. Some of them are reasonable and many are not, about why people don't help in a time of crisis. And those reasons or justifications, they really vary depending on the context. And they can include things like cowardice. Maybe you're fearful of retaliation. Maybe you are just apathetic. You know, you mentioned that a lot of people do have empathy, but I think it's important to recognize that a lot of people unfortunately lack empathy and compassion as well. Other reasons include laziness. They just don't want to put the effort in to help. Some people also claim that they aren't aware of what's even happening. So they claim ignorance or maybe uncertainty, like they're unsure that, you know, a crime is being committed, that maybe they think it's just a disagreement or something. A really interesting excuse that I've come across is allegiance to a criminal perpetrator. So maybe your friend or your relative is actually the perpetrator, and because of loyalty you feel towards that person, you don't want to intervene. And then, as you mentioned, there are some logistical factors, some group dynamics. And so some social psychology research has proposed the theory of the bystander effect, which is derived from something called the distribution of responsibility, or the diffusion of responsibility. And that theory claims that the more people who are around, the less likely it is that any one of them will intervene, because they assume someone else will do it.
That the other person will do it, will intervene. They basically Absolutely. Shock responsibility that somebody else will do it, I don't have to do it.
Absolutely, and that's why, you know, if there is a danger and you're trying to be helpful in this situation, one of the most effective things you can do is to point at someone and say, you call police, you try to perform CPR, you actually single out individuals to do certain tasks so that nobody assumes that someone else is going to do them.
If you're a digital bystander, do you have different responsibilities to the person who is physically present while an action is taking place?
So my most recent article on this topic is called Digital Age Bystanders, and for that article, I did a deep dive into a really shocking case in 2016 in Columbus, Ohio, where the first live streamed rape happened. And over 700 people watched. And by my research, I found only one person who actually tried to be helpful.
Wow.
And so we might have
700 people were watching.
Yeah, 700 people were watching live as this girl was being raped.
Let me ask you this, Professor Kaufman. Is there something about the times that we live in this digital age that makes people less likely to be upstanders, especially younger people who some say get caught up in the need to get more views and more likes?
That's absolutely true. So one of the theories about the live streamer is that she was actually, to borrow your term, which was said by the prosecutor in the case, that she was caught up in the likes, that she really loved the attention that she was getting for live streaming. By the way, it was her best friend who was getting raped.
Wow.
And the live streamer's name is Marina Lonina. So Marina Lonina is live streaming her supposed best friend's rape. And she talks about how she was just, you know, overwhelmed by the positive feedback she was getting from the viewers. that they were, you know, giving likes, that they were following her on social media. And unfortunately, I think also social media does have the potential to desensitize people to, you know, the awful
the things suffering of others
that we see. Absolutely.
Now, we have seen a tendency by people these days to impulsively take out their phones whenever something is happening, you know, capturing it on video to share with their friends. We've seen people filming acts of violence. These videos get shared widely. They go viral, as we say. And in some cases where someone is in danger, you ask, why didn't this person put down the phone and intervene? We have seen numerous cases. What do you say are some of the well-known cases of these digital bystanders or upstanders?
Well, we recently just saw such a case in the Derek Chauvin prosecution, where Derek Chauvin, you know, was convicted of killing George Floyd. Darnella Frazier was just such a third party, and she recorded the murder that former Officer Chauvin perpetrated. And that, I think, was a good thing. It's not always necessarily bad that we record and transmit evidence of serious crimes. In her case, I don't think it would have been reasonable for her to physically intervene. Of course, you know, the officer has a gun. He was already in the process of killing someone. And Darnella Frazier would have been rightly concerned for her own safety. And so the next best thing was to document what was happening. And as the world now knows, that her footage, her recording, her viral video played a crucial, if not essential, role in convicting former officer Chauvin. Mm-hmm. So that would be an example of how a third party can be an upstander by recording what was happening. Of course, they're terrible in many examples of people who record awful things, and it isn't helpful. So one example here would be in Florida a few years ago, four teenagers watched a man named Jamal Dunn drown. And they recorded themselves mocking him, and then they uploaded it to YouTube. And that had no, unlike Darnell Frazier, they had no intention of, you know, bearing witness for a positive purpose. They were just trying to ridicule the man and humiliate him publicly and bring attention to themselves. So it really depends on the context and the intent, of the reporter.
Mm. You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. We're still chatting with Dr. Zachary Kaufman. He's Associate Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of Houston Law Center. And we're talking about digital bystanders and upstanders.
Now, so how is the system responding to this? Are there laws punishing bystanders on the books anywhere?
There are. In fact, by my research, I've found 29 U.S. states plus Puerto Rico already have what I call bad Samaritan laws, and what other people also sometimes call bad Samaritan laws. And these are statutes that impose a legal duty to assist others in peril, either by intervening directly, which is known as the duty to rescue, or by notifying authorities, which is known as the duty to report. So in addition to, in the United States, 29 U.S. states and Puerto Rico having some form of bad Samaritan laws, there is now also a narrow federal bad Samaritan law in 28 that was enacted in 2018 as a direct response to the Nassar case. The Me Too movement, of course, brought attention to rampant sexual abuse that has been unaddressed and then sometimes facilitated by bystanderism. So that particular federal law is a direct response to one of the most notorious Me Too cases. In addition to bad Samaritan laws existing in the United States, dozens of foreign countries have bad Samaritan laws, and I've also found them to exist in multiple subfields of international law.
Mm. Now, so there are laws that punish people who stand by while crime is happening and they don't intervene. Are there laws that reward people who are upstanders?
Well, first of all, I should further mention that even though many of these laws are on the books, they are seldom enforced. So, you know, although, for example, they already exist to some degree in 29 U.S. states, very, very few times are they, individuals actually charged with violations. There aren't necessarily laws that reward people or that impose rewards. But I would argue that society should provide positive incentives to go along with the negative incentives of bad Samaritan laws. You know, some people respond better to carrots rather than sticks. And also, you know, bad Samaritan laws...
The carrot would be the incentive to help.
The positive incentive, yeah. And the negative incentive would be the sticks. Mm. The bad Samaritan laws would be the sticks or the negative incentives. And so I think that it would certainly be appropriate to reward people for doing the right things. You know, doing that can, you know, help to celebrate, a valuable contribution. But it also helps identify individuals whose ideal conduct should be emulated. And you know, then on the flip side, the negative incentives, the sticks, the bad Samaritan laws, you know, demonstrate society's condemnation of apathy and callousness and inaction in a time of crisis. So even if they're not enforced, you know, even to have these laws on the books plays, I think, a very important symbolic role.
Let's take a quick break and listen to your opinions. We'll be right back.
If the president gave his medical team, the army, teachers, now who am I not to be vaccinated? So everybody has to be vaccinated just for the good of the world.
I'm called Simon. I've already been vaccinated and I'm still very skeptical about the virus. I mean, about the vaccine. I'm still not trusting it. I'm not sure what kind of side effects it might have on my life.
No, I haven't been vaccinated. I don't even know where they vaccinate from, so I don't know. I don't feel like comfortable being immunized because I'm not so sure about the vaccine, though I have to. Yeah, be obligated as a Ghanaian to get that vaccine, so probably I will.
My name is Shakuru Kawanguzi, and I'm in Kampala, Uganda. The reason why I'm not yet vaccinated is that it's very hard for me to access the vaccination center or site. I'm not sure of the vaccination schedule and the right place to go and get the vaccine. I was expecting to get some information from our local leaders, to be sensitizing us, to be educating us to where to go and get the vaccine. But they are not well informed also, or they are not interested, I'm not sure.
My name is Itumize Repafla, and I'm not vaccinated. And the reason is, I think it is the first time to see somebody who is talking about the vaccine.
I'm Luswasi, and I've not been vaccinated because, you know, we lack information to access where to get vaccine from. If I've been sensitized before and to know how the vaccine works, how what, and I'm convinced I can.
Many thanks to all of you who contributed your opinions to this week's question of the week. And we want to welcome those who are just joining us. You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. We're still chatting with Dr. Zachary Kaufman. He's Associate Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of Houston Law Center. And we are talking about digital bystanders and upstanders.
Now, there have been some cases, you know, controversial cases where individuals have been celebrated as upstanders, and, you know, become local global heroes. But over time, some contradictions in the historical record, and, you know, people can't seem to agree on whether that person was actually an upstander or not. Can you tell us some of those examples?
Yes, sadly, there's a case, from Rwanda, a country, dear to both you and me. According to the award-winning film of Hotel Rwanda, Paul Rusesabagina saved more than 1,200 people during the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda by sheltering them in the hotel that he managed. But more recently, Rusesabagina's conduct, both during and since the genocide, has come under scrutiny, particularly by his fellow Rwandans. Some survivors who took refuge in the hotel have denounced him, claiming that he actually exploited their desperation to extort money, and that he collaborated with genocide perpetrators. And also, based on his activities since 1994, since the genocide that occurred that year, the Rwandan government has also accused Rusesabagina of terrorism, arson, kidnap, murder, and corruption. And so, this is a fascinating, tragic, notorious case that really demonstrates, I think, that upstander narratives aren't always simple or clear, and that supposed heroes might also or instead be villains.
Mm. Interesting. Professor Kaufman, thank you very much for speaking to us today. I really appreciate your time. Where can people find these resources and some of the work that you've been, some of the research that you've been working on?
All of my scholarship on bystanders and upstanders is available online for free through the Social Science Research Network. And the two most recent major works are titled Digital Age Samaritans, and the other one is Protectors of Predators or Prey. And so if people are interested, they could Google my name, Zachary Kaufman, along with either of those two titles, Digital Age Samaritans or Protectors or Predators or Prey. And then you can click on, there's a blue download this paper button, and you can just download the articles for free.
These are free articles. Your website still standing, ZacharyKaufman.com?
That is true. And all the articles are linked from the website under the publications or writing tab. Okay. And so audience members could read them for free from the website, and I encourage feedback. My research and recommendations on this topic is ongoing. I'm working on now a book on the topic that's under contract with Cambridge University Press. And so there's still, lots of time for folks to add feedback, either suggesting other cases to research, or recommendations, or even pushing back. Maybe you think bad Samaritan laws are a terrible idea. Or maybe you don't think we should reward upstanders. I'd really love to hear from everybody.
Would you call this a new area of research?
It's a new area of research for me. The research or scholarship on bystanders and upstanders has been around for some decades. My argument is that in the legal field, there really hasn't been enough. And also, I'm trying to push the envelope in terms of thinking about modern applications in the digital age, applications to other scenarios that we're confronting. For example, ongoing racialized police brutality. There are certain dynamics that are the subject of my next article that I'll be exploring in that particular context, and that hasn't been done before.
Professor Kaufman, thank you very much. Always breaking new ground in scholarship and research.
Thank you so much, Jackson.
This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. In Nigeria, outcry continues over the decision by the government to suspend Twitter, the popular social media platform used by millions of people in the country. The Buhari administration has gone as far as ordering prosecutors to arrest Twitter users that violate the ban. Meanwhile, the US and the European Union are joining a chorus of voices calling for the reversal of the highly controversial ban, which came a day after the social media giant deleted a tweet from President Buhari's account for violating its quote-unquote abusive behavior policy. The platform, which is reported to have over 39 million users in Nigeria, has often played an important role in driving public sentiments and conversations in the country. Japheth J.J. Omojua is a Nigerian writer and social-political commentator. He has over 1 million followers on Twitter. From Abuja, he joins me to talk about the reaction by Nigerians and the impact that the ban will have around the country.
Well, this has been coming. As at 6-7 years ago, we've been battling different forms of attempts at gagging social media. Some of those laws were actually outrightly anti-social media laws. Some of them were hidden inside other laws that did not outrightly mention the word social media, like frivolous abuse and other petitions, for instance. And after that, I think it came to a head in 2020 when social media proved very, very influential during the NSAS movement in the latter part of 2020. And the government did pay extra attention to the power of social media and what people are able to do with it. Mm. Then another turning point definitely was when 3 days ago, Twitter deleted President Buhari's tweet, and the government didn't like that at all. And I don't think, I was shocked, really. I'm still kind of shocked. But nobody would be surprised that after that, that the action of suspending Twitter in Nigeria and the fact that Twitter deleted the president, it is not difficult to see a correlational and causative effect for both actions.
So the original tweet was not sent out by the president himself. It was part of a speech that he gave. Who tweeted it out?
It was from the president's handle. And these tweets were posted before the video came out. So in fact, before the video came out, there was a lot of accusation being thrown at specific handlers of the president. Different men in his team that are spokespeople of the president, the senior ones and the younger ones. And so it was an assumption that they're not handling this guy well. Like, why would they even post something like that? And then a video came out where the president was using exact words. But a fair person would say that it was more nuanced in the video, because there was a full pause between the reference to the Biafra war and what he intended to do to those that are making trouble today. Mm-hmm. But in the tweet, it looked like he packed everyone in the southeast of Nigeria together, and that's a very, very big difference.
So something was lost in translation between the...
For sure, without a question. For instance, the president's people could easily defend the video and say, look, this is what was being said, this was what was being intended. But I don't think they can defend the tweet standing alone. It's almost impossible to defend the tweet standing alone.
Now, is Buhari a prolific Twitter user himself?
I don't think Buhari has ever tweeted himself before, maybe except for a perfunctory tweet before during the elections. I think his page is 100% being managed by his team. I don't think Buhari tweets by himself. Mm. I don't think so. I may be wrong, but I don't think so.
And how popular is Twitter in Nigeria? What
extremely popular, massively popular. Mm. Twitter is massively popular. Twitter may not win you elections, but it affects your perception as a public servant. Twitter doesn't have as many people as Facebook in Nigeria, but the opinions that get shared on Twitter, the messages, the stories that fly from Twitter, they go into other platforms, including Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, and eventually even to the conventional media space, radio, right, and TV. So Twitter is such a powerful platform. And as you can see, the Twitter ban is in virtually every news network, is the biggest conversation in Nigeria as we speak, even though there are far more important issues. I'm not saying that this is not an important issue, but with hundreds of people being kidnapped and people being killed, you would agree with me that ordinarily this should be far more important.
And with that, we come to the end of our show. Many thanks to our guests, Professor Kaufman in Houston and J.J. Omojua in Abuja, Nigeria. Remember to check out our website for our podcast. It's at voanews.com/upfront. That is voanews.com/upfront. We are also on all social media platforms, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at VOA Upfront. That's VOA Upfront. Until next time, as our elders say, having a good discussion is like having riches. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Have a great week ahead, Africa.